The commissioner will talk about a little later the facility consolidations that are being proposed and the update of the service level standards. So he will cover that in more detail in the next presentation. In organization and staffing, the reductions related to the implementation of the blueprint organizational and staffing changes, the transfer of the Dulles Toll Road to MWA, reductions in facilities repairs, furniture, equipment, security, training, and environmental services. Those are some of the things that we reduced in the admin portion of the budget. And we've had to set aside some funding for a reserve for severance costs related to the layoff. Now, this budget, the maintenance budget, I'm narrowing the focus to maintenance for 10. What you have here on this slide shows you the original and revised 09 and they're proposed for 10. Now, the way this chart is set up is it shows that we've compartmentalized the maintenance budget into two large categories, asset investment and services. And where you see the significant change is you see $100 million reduction in services from 2010 to the original 2009, and you've seen an increase of $112 million in pavement. This is where we're turning the focus to maintaining existing infrastructure, and you'll see a slight increase in bridge, and the other asset investments are of a smaller item, list of items, and the commissioner can speak to that. But we've reduced services to accommodate the increase in infrastructure maintenance. So the total, again, and this matches to the previous slide, we've gone for maintenance from $1,349,000. In 09 revised, it was a matter of balancing. So we just, at the time of year that we had to reduce the budget and adopt in February, we were basically just finding where we could save money anywhere we could save it. So the program dropped to $1,186,000. In proposed 2010, we're at $1,359,000. This is with additional federal funding to offset the loss of state revenues for maintenance, so we've moved more federal dollars into the maintenance program for what can be federalized, and it's at about a level of 14%. Previously, in 09, it was 11%.
Mr. Chairman, I'm curious if it's not possible to consider at this stage, before we get to the June vote on this budget, a slight shift from moving $100 million to maintenance to backing off that commitment slightly and be able to preserve some of these essential services that we've been talking about for one more year while we look for some solutions to providing those services through other means. It seems to me, and I know I've said this already, but I'll repeat it one more time, to put a barrier up at these rest areas on July 1 and do nothing to remove the pavement and the buildings, to do nothing to provide additional parking for trucks and RVs and other vehicles on the interstates, it does not seem to me to be wise to make that big a shift in one year with such short notice. I think I could accept this, I know I could, a year from now, if we had really tried to make clear to members of the General Assembly and others what is going to happen, that we are going to actually ask for money to tear down the bathrooms and take up the pavement and restore these areas to natural areas, or we're going to convert them into truck parking and do whatever is legal as far as any charges or whatever that might support that, even if we get no support for it. The need for it is huge. Why can't we consider not making that big a shift and back off and pick up some of these essential services for one more year while we try to impress upon the General Assembly the fact that we believe it's not in the interest of the Commonwealth to take all of those actions. I can accept the fact that 125-mile separation between rest areas is probably smart. What I cannot accept at this stage is that we're just going to put up a barrier and say and not spend any money to fix those areas and to make help people understand, especially all the visitors that come to Virginia, why we're doing it. They don't know about our budget situation. Every state you travel, and I rode the interstates for the last 2 weeks between here and Florida, and I can tell you those rest areas are hugely important all up and down that corridor. And there is varying quality in different states, but nonetheless, their importance is clear. And in all the hearings, I know the commissioner got an earful, and I thank him for doing everything that he did to listen to people. I have not heard a single person come to me that says they want these rest areas closed. And I've tried to explain that 30 or 40 miles apart is probably not good policy currently, that some will have to be closed, but I think the way we do it is really crucial. And as I see this shift of $100 million in 1 year, I just don't think it's wise. I think it ought to be done over a couple of years rather than 1 year. So that's my say again before we get to this June vote, where I can't support this action the way we currently have it constituted. And I feel badly because I know we have to balance this budget, and I'm willing to be part of that. I just don't like the priority that we've set for doing it.
I'm sure others in Mr. Sterling wants to comment. You're welcome to make a specific proposal with respect to that that staff can consider, you know, at the end when we go around the table. But I would say this. We have adopted performance measures on pavement. We have gone backwards on that due to increased costs, weather conditions, and age of our infrastructure. And in some parts of the state, you drove in on I-64 today, You see how terrible it is. That is something that is irreversible if we continue in that decline. By code, by the Appropriations Act, by our own internal policies, the adequate maintenance, our pavement of bridges is our first responsibility. And after that, other things come. So that's how the commissioner has developed this budget, and these recommendations is in reflection of that. Those priorities. But if you want to, again, keep in mind that pie chart, want to make a recommendation, we'll have that discussion. It ought to be very specific
When would that be then?
When we get to the end of these presentations, but I think it also, in fairness to the commissioner, you need to hear what's being recommended with respect to mowing, safety service patrols, rest areas.
He's done a good job, Mr. Chairman. He's done a good job explaining that.
Yes, sir. Okay. Mr. Sterling.
Yeah, this may be one of those areas where colleagues can disagree. It's not necessarily the merits of having the rest stops or maintaining all the rest stops or not, but we're in a situation where it's a very tight budget environment. It gets tighter every year. And I understand the idea or the concept of hoping for another year that somebody, one of the elected officials, whether it be at the state, General Assembly, or up in the federal government, will take action either to provide more resources or to give us certain authorities. But I've found that nothing crystallizes their ability to make decisions so much as something that stares them right in the face. And while you've got another year, that's not staring them right in the face. That's not forcing a decision. That's not saying, here is the consequences. It's a couple of words on a chart or in a letter or even spoken on the phone. But if we're going to get to this point because the authorities don't exist or because the funding doesn't exist, then I think we should do it now. If they determine they don't like that, and we can continue to advocate that those authorities or that revenue become available or be made available, if they don't like the rest areas closed, then they'll know, they'll see it. I mean, as long as we're just telling them this is what's going to happen, I can tell you that they're going to look at, well, that'll happen later, I'll deal with that later. I mean, there's a lot of funding constraints that they're making some choices. As long as you're kicking this down the road, they're going to continue to kick it down the road. So if we want action to be taken, we've got it. This is the time to take it.
Mr. Chairman, I just simply say to my colleague, potholes that are a foot wide or 3 foot wide in the road and no paving will get their attention as quick as closing a rest area. So all I'm saying is balance, and I don't think there's any balance here. I think the ferries, definitely a couple $1 million will take care of that problem, and probably $5 to $8 million would take care of some of the rest area challenges for a year, maybe $10 million. Out of this total of $100 million, to me, it's worth considering, and I will, at the proper time, present some ideas for how we try to do that.
Okay. Ms. Buescher.
The last slide I have, and up on the screen it's a little difficult to see, but this shows the 09 original budget by district, broken down by the asset investment, services, and reserves. The middle section of the chart is the proposed cuts, and these are at the level that were originally proposed. So these will change with whatever budget decisions the CTB makes. And then the 10 draft proposed budget, again, by district. So you've gone, this is by district, the total to get you to the $1,359,000 for 10, again, by asset investment and services. It was just another way of showing the slide previously with the cuts identified. That's all I have.
Any other questions of Ms. Buescher? Okay. The next scintillating presentation will be made once again by Commissioner Eckern. Welcome back, Commissioner.
I'll pick up from this and now add a little bit of detail for discussion this afternoon. Again, on the this now will deal specifically with the five service areas that we placed on the table for consideration and took to public meeting. Again, I won't recover this slide that I used in the introduction. This is strictly, hopefully brings you to the fact that we're talking about the 13% or the, see, I guess my colors don't match up, the 15% of the pie. Now that I'm, not, you know, it always is impressive when you look at your presentations in real life after you've been working on them for a week. And this is a set of talking points for you as we talk about that 72, 15, and 13, and gives you the highlights of where that focus is at. Again, the appropriation direction. And now picking up from the status report that we gave and when we initiated the hearings in March, there are essentially 18 service areas that you look at, and if you think about it from that center line to the edge line. I've highlighted on this slide for you two key points, one, or actually three key points. One, highlighted in orange, are the service areas specifically that we had proposed for reduction or and or elimination. Secondly, I put a noted point under snow and ice control so that we remain perfectly focused on what was on the table versus what we heard a lot of comments about in a lot of areas across the Commonwealth. And that deals with we are not changing snow and ice control standards, and we are not instructing districts to change any practices that they have been employing. Very frankly, I think you would have detected those changes as a result of the closure of the and consolidation of the area headquarters back in 2006. We've gone through two winters now. We eased our way into that back in 2006. And actually transitioned so that the we're fairly confident that our practices in the field remain consistent, even though the core where you would have expected it to change was consolidated back in 2006.
What's the vegetation control and mowing services? I'm trying to get an idea.
Vegetation control, and I've had to do a little bit of lumping. Vegetation control really deals on the TAMS side of the interstate maintenance side of the contract. And when you look at those categories, it really starts to deal with what are you doing for brushing, tree trimming, versus just grass mowing.
If I could make two comments before you get into the individual service areas. On slide four, the outlook by program, if you could just back up for 1 second. The very last point on this slide, average annual growth in maintenance payments to cities and counties also reduced from 4% to 3%, and then went above it, reduced average annual growth from 4% to 3% in the maintenance program. That is not addressing need. And so even with the one-time infusion of money into pavements, we are not keeping up with our long-time estimated necessary growth rate of 4%. Some years it's more, some years it's less. That is a very, very significant change. And over 20 years, that one percentage point makes a huge difference. But I point that out to you because that is a major change in a way that we have operated since 2002, when we made an estimate of, on balance, what it would take to keep up with the inflationary costs associated with the maintenance program. We know 3% is not adequate. It is what we can afford.
Mr. Chairman, so from a year ago when we saw rapidly escalating asphalt prices and so forth, this year we're seeing certainly a dramatic moderation of some of those things. So this doesn't just reflect a lower rate of increase in materials. This
Correct.
Is actually deciding we don't need that many legs, and so we'll just have one less.
It's just decided all we can afford is three. And there is a big question mark over even this, what looks to be very significant increases in the maintenance program is still not a needs-based maintenance program. And when you factor in bridges, obviously that.
Mr. Chairman, isn't that not just bad business, but isn't that fundamentally dishonest? Just pretending like we don't need something
No.
so we don't have to have it in the budget?
What you will see either June and July is a long-term forecast of what we need. We're very confident about the ability to meet some targets in the six-year program for pavements and for bridges, and one of the things that the commissioner is doing is say we're going to meet those targets, but the services are going to continue to get squeezed. That's the dynamic that is being set into place. The same is occurring at the local level when we're only going at 3%. So this is a very important but big change in a way that we've operated since 2002. Second thing and point to make is the commissioner is not talking about this rest area here or that mowing that there. He is establishing statewide standards for these services, whether it's safety patrol, whether it's ferry, et cetera, et cetera. And so when we talk about budget reductions, we need to talk about changing standards as opposed to individual facilities, a residency, a ferry service, an area for mowing.
Mr. Chairman, could I go back to six and the traffic operations / it's SFC for the safety patrol?
Yes.
Okay, but the...
Well, that's essentially the motorist assist element is all I've looked
right,
at.
Right, right. But it still includes traffic operations
yes.
as well, which in our urban areas is
yes.
congestion mitigation measures.
That's correct.
Mr. Chairman, what is the service that has to do with sound barriers? Is that maintaining them?
Yeah, as we look at it, that's the physical maintenance of them that you need to do, periodic repairs, those kinds of activities. As we were trying to capture our assets that you take care of from the center line out, that's a physical asset that you need to take care of.
And while we're at it, a couple of other clarifications, what is fence management?
Same thing. You've got interstate fences that need to be repaired, so we keep that on the list for our maintenance staffs.
And sidewalks and trails?
Sidewalks and trails are in our subdivisions and in our secondary streets programs where you have sidewalks that are part and parcel of your facility. So some of our districts are, in fact, having to repair sidewalks within the right-of-way.
I had no idea. Boy, that ought to go.
Mr. Chairman, could I ask, are those budgets significant for sidewalks and sound barriers, or are they tiny?
Mr. Chairman, if you, and I thought about your question because it dawned on me this morning about the question of, the natural question of, what are the high-value items that are in here? We picked the high-value items that did not affect emergency response in that first category and in the second category and the third category. So what we tried to get was, if I'd have picked, as an example, if we'd have gone out and said, tell you what, we're not going to maintain noise walls, you wouldn't have been able to find it in the budget, per se. So that's the key.
That's what I was asking. Thank you.
Now let me run you down the details of the story that starts from what we proposed, what we heard that we briefed you on last month, and what I'm recommending as the resolution. On the left-hand side for Interstate Maintenance Services, otherwise known as TAMS, you've got the brief snapshot again. $78 million annually, 13 contracts, 4 companies, and they focus around the routine maintenance services such as mowing, litter control. We had proposed a $10 to $15 million reduction. We are continuing to pursue the scope change of those contracts. We are in negotiations with the companies now. And as future contracts, as these contracts come due, we're going to look to consolidate and permanentize those scope changes in future contracts. So at this stage in negotiations, we are at about $8 million that we can count on in terms of what we think we will achieve out of against that $10 to $15 million goal. We will complete negotiations by June 1st, and we are able to implement whatever changes we finally agree to with the partner companies July 1st. So,
are these contracts by districts, or are they over all?
No, they were set up on 13 different segments, so some districts may have 2 or 3 different contracts within their boundaries, and that's why as we move forward, one of our learning pieces has been to say there may be a smarter way to do that contract, but at the time we deployed them, they were deployed in a way that we felt would attract good business from the contracting industry.
Thank you.
The second service area was then the roadside management, roadside services. I tried to find 40 titles for you, but the majority of this is mowing on the primary and secondary systems, in which we're investing about $42 million annually. Our proposal was to reduce spending by $20 million. We have established, and the next slide in your slide set shows you the mowing standards that we have been pursuing. Statewide mowing practices are adjusted to that, which guarantees 3 mowings per year. What we have changed is instead of right-of-way to right-of-way width in those mowings, now we'll narrow the swaths down to the ditch bottoms, essentially, and we will move to a pattern in which you will see full right-of-way mowing, but probably on a 4-year rotation instead of every year. We are also installing and authorizing, or would authorize the districts within their budgets to move that standard. In other words, if you need to mow more frequently in an urban area for a reason and you can trade that off within your budget, we'll be glad to do that. Would be authorized. We are in the process and have had bids out for our bid contract mowing. I'm getting good reports. It turns into about mowing half the acreage on those bids by acres across the Commonwealth. So so it tells me we're on track to achieve that $20 million reduction. There's a sidelight note in here in the wildflower program investment. We are recommending to limit that to the funding generated by the license plate program that supports that program.
How much is that?
That's about $100,000 a year. We've been subsidizing that with an additional $500,000. So you'll see an impact on wildflower management.
Mr. Chairman, it's harder to see them when they're not mowed around.
That's a good comment.
What do you
every four, every, about every fourth year. The slide that I've included here will give you what that mowing standard would be. This is not a potentially new standard, but we are. This is not a new standard, but we are uniformly applying it across the Commonwealth. So you will feel tension in urban areas. And again, I'd like to highlight that the districts do have the ability and the authority to adjust based on local condition.
Okay, I'm trying back on the, if you could. You've got
Mr. Sterling.
We've got two areas where you're just talking about cool weather, not warm.
They're trying to describe the turf species that we would use. These are charts from our agronomist staff. Our
so because you have different turf in those areas, that's the reason
that,
you'd be...
That will vary your mowing. That's why you vary your mowing time. But your point is well taken. These are professionally driven standards. And so these have emerged from department professionals, experts in these areas. The third area that we took to hearing and service reduction was the safety service patrols. Again, the background and what we had proposed in terms of reconfiguring the service to save, in essence, about $2 to $5 million against an annual $10 million investment. This does not take out the TOCs. It only talks about the on-road motorist assist service. We're proposing now and recommending that we would achieve, and I'll show it to you on the next slide, a service level that we generally had in about 2001 in terms of areas. We would reduce to only providing the service in two areas, Hampton Roads and Northern Virginia. In Hampton Roads, we are doing that by contract today. So we would reduce that by about 12 contract positions and cover less mileage. In Northern Virginia, that service would be scaled to the existing in-house staff that we have. And we would eliminate then the contract-provided safety service patrols in all the other districts. That estimate now will achieve about a $6.5 million reduction as opposed to the initial estimates that we had at 2 to 5. This chart, while it is a little bit small and hard to read, is very telling and gets you the specifics by area and district of the state. If you look at the 1, 2, 3, fourth column over, you will see the total mileages that are currently covered by the program. This third column from the left will show you the interstate where those services are provided. You will get a sense from the next two columns that will give you our reduction and what we would achieve in terms of savings estimated for that individual segment. And at the end, you see in the fourth column, or in the next to the last column, the actual mileages of coverage. In the Hampton Roads area, it would be reduced from about 113 miles of coverage to about 48 miles. In Northern Virginia and the 95 leg coming down into Fredericksburg, you'll see a reduction, and somebody will have to add those up for me because even my bifocals don't work on these numbers. But you'll see that in Northern Virginia, we'll retain the same mileages of coverage. What you will see change is the frequency at which you would see a safety service patroller passing a particular point. As a general rule of thumb, today you see a safety service patroller pass a point on the freeway at about 20-minute increments. We would expand that increment in the actual time. We haven't worked that fully through the system yet since we haven't finalized the recommendations. That will bring the total mileage of coverage back to about 190 miles, if I read that last number down at the bottom, about right. And that's about where we were in 2001.
Kind of a question. So in the Richmond district, is it all contracting services now provided, no VDOT employees?
That's correct.
And it will, if the contract people are eliminated, then...
That's correct.
So where does, how do you provide emergency coverage if there isn't anybody dedicated to it?
That's our maintenance workforce. Those are the normal, these are safety service patrollers who are roving, and so we go from a roving directed system to a, now you use your duty officer, your TOC, and you contact your area headquarters or your TAMS contractor to respond to the issue.
Huh. Well, as someone who has benefited from the service, I can say it's a valuable service, and I don't know, I've got to do some thinking about some of these things. Based on what I'm hearing when I talk to people in the coffee shop, I tell them, or I ask them, really, what do you think about this? What do you think about that? And they see it a little differently than we insiders tend to see it.
Appreciate that. That's a very valid comment. I get emails and letters constantly from people who have gotten a gallon of gasoline or 5 gallons of gasoline. General Assembly members have received the service. They are clearly a great face for transportation when you provide that service.
Commissioner, is there not also, though, a state police service, motorist assistance?
There is a limited service here in the Richmond area that is provided through the state police. They have a motorist assist program. You'll generally recognize them as a car rather than our truck, and it has a motorist assist, and they do not provide the same kinds of services that our people were providing. So there is a little bit of a differentiation, but that was the predecessor in the Richmond area.
Every time I set aside the fact that, yeah, they can't do a police officer or state trooper can't give the full range of services, I've never seen somebody that ran out of gas on the side of the road that trooper couldn't help. I mean, don't they help in a situation? So really, what are the what would be missed there?
In the high volume areas, in the congested areas, the whole impetus for this program nationwide was twofold. One, modeled a lot of around the Chicago Minuteman program, where they have a very aggressive heavy equipment and the authority for the Chicago DOT to move in and clear vehicles with their equipment and restore service. The second piece of that, which most states were looking at, is in this motorist assist, because we know that every time you have a stalled vehicle on the side of the road, that has an impact downstream on traffic, the Gawker effect. And so if you can clear those, that will help with congestion.
But I'm trying to get an idea. If it's a flat tire, most people, not everyone, have a spare tire, a jack. They have the means of doing that. They can be assisted. I'm trying to get an idea of what would be the total scope, not just identifying, well, you won't have this or this, but in terms of its usage.
I'm working very hard not to answer the question the way I would normally answer it, which is the hard policy question outside the congestion piece. Is this a service that I should be performing that has alternatives to it? And that's the question you're asking. Is there AAA? Is there someone else that can be providing those services now that we have cell phones and vehicles? Yes, you can, if you subscribe to AAA. So there are all kinds of examples that will argue either way for the service. Building to the two most popular services that were debated and discussed is first the ferry services. here was what we proposed, a reduction in the service and an elimination of one of the services. Annual cost for these services was about $12 million, and we were looking for $2 million. We obviously got an awful lot of feedback from the public on these, on this particular service area. Our recommendation is going to be, and obviously a strong direction, Jamestown Scotsman, we will maintain 24-hour, 7-day-a-week service. As a course, and very frankly, as a part of that public meeting, we heard from the customer that there were things that we ought to look at that could reduce and achieve that same cost savings. So the district and our operations staff are in discussion now in streamlining some of our internal operations and properly scoping and adjusting the scope of our security plan on the ferry as it services across Jamestown. And they are in active discussion working with the Coast Guard. We believe that the combination of those two or three items will achieve us about a $1.1 million reduction as opposed to eliminating one of the hours of operation or eight of the hours of operation. That is a work in progress, and we think we'll have that resolved by the 1st of June or implementation July 1st. We are recommending elimination of the Hatton Ferry. And we have, as you'll see noted in those slides, adjusted the schedule for both the Merry Point and the Sunnybank ferries to achieve our originally targeted 50% savings in operation. While not a lot in absolute dollars, it is a recognition that we are dealing with that whole issue. And it probably reflects more accurately what those ferry services are providing in those three other locations. That will get us about $1.2 or $1.3 million in savings. Additionally, the public was very attuned to the fact that our fleet is aging at Jamestown Scotsman. So we are actively pursuing funding for a replacement ferry. We submitted to the Federal Highway Administration last week an application under ERA for a unique piece of, there's a unique program, $60 million for ferry replacement identified. So we have sent in our application as a first step to seek funding for that anticipated $30 million replacement. They're promising a rapid turnaround. I'm not sure how fast that will come. But the service, the changes that we're making here, we are able to implement July 1st, as we've indicated. So our implementation to take effect for this $1.3 million would start July 1st.
Mr. Chairman, to my fellow board members, these public hearings on the ferry were, the commissioner did a great job, and people were very angry and upset and concerned, but I'm really glad to hear about looking for this alternative, because what I ended up saying to the group was we're dealing with a recommendation today, and the fact of the matter is this situation is just going to be exacerbated a few years down the road. Our ferries are very, very old. They have exhausted their useful life, or close to it, nearly to a state of where you're not going to be able to repair them through another cycle. And if we don't get to this grant, we're applying for $30 million out of a total of a $60 million bucket. Is that what I heard you say? You know, if we don't get this, we're going to be faced with this problem in the near future. We have no construction money, no ability to put in new ferry service. A number of people and a whole region area on the Isle of Wight, Surrey side of the water that relies on this, and we have no money to replace the equipment. So all I'm offering here is good job. We've solved the problem for today. We're trying to solve the problem for tomorrow, but boy, is this a haunting prospect.
As a little bit of a highlight, I get almost daily updates from the Hampton Roads District staff now because our fleet is aging, it is one of the boats is constantly, or ships is constantly in dry dock, having something done to it. We're supposed to put 3 boats into service this weekend. We may or may not make it, because we got one of the boats back yesterday and they discovered problems as they were fitting it out and getting it ready to put back in service. And so the staff is really doing yeoman duty trying to put that boat into service this weekend for Memorial Day weekend.
Mr. Chairman, I know this was one of the most vexing of the problems, but clearly committing to a solution that involves new capital expenditure, we're also committing to a solution that involves ongoing operating subsidies. I think we just have to weigh all these things together. Everybody's got important things that need to be done. It's hard to see. I don't know. It's very difficult for me to see how we promise things we don't have. And when you buy new equipment, you're basically promising somebody's going to operate it, and I'm not sure where that money is.
I think what the commissioner, though, has presented here is the savings are achieved by reducing security on there. The Coast Guard requirement saves about $1.1 million, and that's the annual operational subsidy. The replacement boat, that's 100% funding under the stimulus program.
That's one new ferry?
That's one, correct.
3 to go?
Bingo.
They ain't cheap.
The last area that we put into the public hearing process for service reduction was the rest areas and welcome centers. Again, the snapshot that we started on the left, proposal to close 25 rest areas with an annual $12 million operational savings as a result. You see on that left-hand column the criteria that we used in establishing the original closure list. We added a filter as a result of the public meetings that were held. It was very evident that a 300-mile spacing was a little bit draconian on the part of the public's belief of where we ought to head, recognizing that if we had to do something, this was a little bit over. And I'm the first one to admit that if somebody comes with a plan and says we've got another way to look at this, we did that. We added the filter and moved to a 120-mile spacing generally. It may be 125. Unfortunately, my predecessors didn't plant these things at the right spacing to give me increments of 60 and 120. So I'll take that. Our proposal now is we are adding back 6 rest areas, 4 in the 81 corridor and 2 in the 95 corridor. They are shown in the map on the next slide, and we'll come to that quickly. Let's flip to that one. I've circled them in green, and you have a list there on I-81. Northbound, we would restore put back in the Ironto facility at mile point 129. The New Market facility at 262, that's on the northbound approaches of 81. Southbound, we would reinstall Radford at 108 and Fairfield at 195. On 95, the circle that you see there, there's a complex of 4 facilities there. They are both car and truck. Mm-hmm. We would restore the truck rest area at mile point on both north and southbound at mile point 154. That's the way the proposal is now modified. In addition, we heard quite a bit of comment about the loss of truck parking. So in the next slide, and the audience can't read this, but this gives you a full list of all 42 rest areas that were under consideration. Those above the line are the ones that would remain. The ones below in with that gray box off to their right are the ones that we would now be closing. The staff did just an absolutely fabulous job of reanalyzing where we're at with 700, we provided today totally about 783 spaces. We were going to lose about 225 with the closing of 25 rest areas. 783, we were closing 25, that loses 225. They went back and reanalyzed our parking patterns at each of the sites. And this slide illustrates what that parking pattern looks like now as it's proposed. They, in fact, those red and light blue represent trucks. And adjusted parking utilizing interior space and shoulders within the existing rest areas. Now you take that model, and they've actually modeled every site that would remain open, and you go back to this chart, and you are able to tell how many spaces, truck spaces, at each site they can reinstall by doing that kind of an analysis. The number comes to 225 minimum. So in essence, what we are doing is reestablishing the 783 parking spaces that we currently provide back in the corridors where they were originally placed. That's the shortest way I can figure out to explain complex math. But we get back to 783 and may be able to squeeze a few more. The other piece that we picked up at the public hearings was a concern about parking restrictions. Today we have a 2-hour parking restriction at all the facilities for truck parking. As we have reviewed the record, the only requirement we have is that we not allow overnight parking.
What is the reason for these restrictions originally?
Well, you've got to look back in history a little bit, and across our history, there's been a couple of motivations for 2-hour parking. Part of it had to do with crime prevention. Part of it had to do with making sure that there was turnover at the sites so that somebody didn't take up the whole site for 24 hours. So over time, various states have implemented various kinds of practices. Over that same period, we've improved lighting. We've improved the quality of the facilities. We've done a lot to deal with those issues that were crime prevention kind of issues. Many states, including us, have installed offices at each of their sites so the state police have a place to be. The 2-hour restriction is probably, if you think about it, a vestige of part of that, part of making sure that you have turnover in the sites prior to when private sites were available. I mean, if you look at the corridors in total, we've got over 6,000 truck parking sites along those corridors. So I represent about a little less than 7% of the total available parking in these same corridors. So we're going to propose a removal of that 2-hour restriction and just enforce no overnight parking. That's currently what is in rule for the Commonwealth. So that's a quick move. Also, we have will propose, and the board has already adopted a resolution to pursue commercialization aggressively and reauthorization. So that will continue to be a position. The discussion is about to start in Congress over the reauthorization. So as we move into the fall, that will be a critical point. Failing that, and that's point 6, we will consider and bring a proposal back for responding to what Dr. Davis has talked about in terms of raising the sites and not leaving them as an eyesore, and would begin that process in 2011. We will achieve, as a result of this change, about $9 million in reductions as opposed to our original targeted 12. In total, when you look now at the services, our goal initially had been in the $45 to $50 million range in reductions in these selected services. Currently, we're looking at about $44.1 million. So we're relatively close to the low end of what we thought we could achieve. Not all in exactly the same places that we thought it was going to be, but pretty close. Questions on where we're at? And these recommendations will... I'm sorry, let me move forward. Last slide on rest areas and welcome centers. Contractor notifications would occur. This is our way of making sure that everybody knows we can achieve and implement these reductions July 1st. Sites will be decommissioned. We've got to shutter some plumbing, do some things like that for buildings to winterize them for the decommissioned sites. And we would get then the permanent traffic barriers placed at the sites in this fall coming into the winter. Additional questions on services?
Mr. McCarthy.
Well, it's more of an observation. Could you put the map back up again? Well, it's hard to read, but poor little old Interstate 85, I rise to speak on its behalf. there is a rest area, a rather nice one, at the line as you come from North Carolina into heaven in Virginia. There is a lovely rest stop, and then between there and Petersburg there are two more which are proposed in the commissioner's plan to be eliminated. There is also one in Goochland just west of Richmond proposed to be eliminated. There is also one in Caroline just north of Richmond proposed to be eliminated. The net effect on the traveling public who are rushing from one place to another is when they come into Virginia, if they skip the rest stop on I-85 at the border, the next opportunity they will have is somewhere around Fredericksburg, which I believe is more than 120 miles north of the border from I-85's start in Virginia. Or if they're heading towards Charlottesville, the next opportunity is west of Charlottesville, which again is more than 120 miles. So you're not going to have any public rest area between the North Carolina line going 85 up through 95 to Fredericksburg or 85 up to 64 past Charlottesville. That strikes me as not providing adequate service to the traveling public, and I hope you can at least reconsider that. And I'll have a suggestion later if you want, Mr. Chairman, as to where we might find the bucks to do that, because it's about $250,000 a year for the Dinwiddie one. To think that we're talking here about $9 million in savings out of a $3-point-something-billion annual budget to close all these rest areas, there is something fundamentally screwy about what's going on here that we've been put in that position.
Mr. Chairman.
I'm sorry, Ms. Connolly, and then Ms. Carter.
I have gotten a lot of communication about the Welcome Center in Manassas. And I was like to inquire just if the Department of Tourism, have they weighed in on any of these closures, particularly of the Welcome Centers? And were they not willing to, did they ever offer to put some money on the table, or has that discussion ever taken place?
In the course of the public hearings and since the announcements in February, I personally, or as a commissioner, have received no formal proposal that proposes some alternative funding mechanism. I don't know if the secretary has received something.
They don't have money. These welcome centers are essentially supported by VDOT. This is another one of those services that comes out of the trust fund to other agencies. I have communicated the original as well as the revised draft to the Secretary of Commerce and Trade. This is not a surprise to the tourism folks.
And they, have never initiated some kind of a collaborative approach toward keeping...
They're in the same posture of every other agency of state government. They're contracting rapidly.
Mr. Chairman, I would say the agency hasn't responded, but the tourist attractions have responded aggressively. saying that they want their agency to speak up and they want to find revenues to keep at least some of these rest areas open. I'd like to applaud the commissioner for this. I had not seen the last part. He had told me, but I just hadn't seen it as clearly. I still believe that there is a basis for a discussion among our board to see if we can agree or disagree for delaying this action for 1 year. And I really believe it's important to consider that rather than putting up barriers, temporary barriers, and telling our external public coming through Virginia, and they come through Virginia by the thousands on Interstate 95, 81, 85, 64, that we're not, it's not a welcome place. Now, the welcome centers are beautiful. I applaud a state for that. But these rest areas are really important to people. And I agree that I think we can close several of them, and I think the 130 mile is reasonable. But then you've got properties that are going to sit there to be vandalized and to be a serious eyesore problem. And in 1 year, I think we could approach the General Assembly with the governor's help to say, we don't want that to happen. We do want to reduce the number of rest areas we have. We want to make them more functional for trucks and campers and other things that need to stop. And I was delighted that Newmarket, for instance, was added back in, because if the traffic got off at Newmarket and went into that little town, the trucks, it would be a disaster, because there's a sharp turn there. There's no place for trucks to go, no parking. That's a good example of a good common sense decision. The rest could be evaluated, and I believe some of them could be closed or converted to parking. I'd like to suggest that we approach the General Assembly, if we could, as a board, saying we would like your support for closing some of these properly, that is funding the some $20 million that will probably be required to tear down the buildings and clean up the pavement and restore a natural look, so it doesn't look like we're putting up clothes for business. That would be one consideration. I'd like to suggest that we support funding, ask them to support funding for the DMV, state police, and these others, other than from the trust fund, so that those funds can be available. They may say no. But I think we ought to ask for that.
Dr. Davis, can we get through this presentation? Because, commissioners, you're getting off onto a larger discussion, and the commissioner has another presentation, because I will tell you, one of the trade-offs here are facilities versus layoffs. And I have some personal opinions about that. I'd like to get to other people, and we'll come back to your budget.
Can I finish? Just 1 second.
No. You're making a large budget proposal. We're going to go around at the end of that after the commissioner's had an opportunity to make his entire presentation.
Very good. Thank you.
Okay. I'm okay.
Ms. Carter?
I'm okay.
Okay.
He can continue, because Dr. Davis,
okay,
is on what I wanted to.
We're not
okay.
Giving the commissioner the due he
That's
deserves.
That's right. So
okay, he needs the ability to make his entire presentation.
Yeah, I'll
I don't want to be accused of not giving his dues, because he's done his work very well, and I apologize if I have intruded on his time.
Mr. Chairman, is the final step away from this set of services as they're proposed. The fiscal year 10 anticipated impact is about $45 million. When you extend that out, and I've approached these as permanent changes, fiscal year 11 through 14, the estimates are around $180 million for this portion of the service reduction. With that, I'll give you an update and status on organization and staffing. This is a little bit different in that we're on a trajectory that is doing some work. Some of these decisions are not decisions that will roll to the board per se, much like all the service decisions will. I won't belabor the initial set of slides that are still there to keep integrity, but I did want to point out that we are continuing in our organizational and staffing approaches a journey that is not new. It has its seeds prior to the beginning of the 21st century It was highlighted in a series of JLARC studies done in 2001 and 2002. And since 2002, we keep reminding everyone who will listen, VDOT is a vastly different place than it was at the turn of the century. It is not finished getting where it's going. But what is happening now is we are accelerating that pace of achieving that organization that was envisioned through all of these discussions. So you have seen the organization shrink from 10,500 to 8,600. We have adopted, and in the quarterly reports that you will get tomorrow or have at your places, we are achieving and sustaining on time and on budget focus for the agency. We have, in fact, consolidated our area headquarters back in 2006. At the same time, we consolidated sign shops from 7 locations to 1 here in the Richmond area. And we have taken the first steps at functionalizing the department when we, in the 2004 time frame, changed our construction focus from the residency location to be managed from a district location, and introduced 50 PEs into our business at that same time. So as you look at the principles that drive the organizational and staffing dynamic, they continue that philosophy and business approach that the department has been on. I'll flip past this and get to a status report on the staffing. As you saw in the legislation, obviously, our target organization size is 7,500 by July of 2010. I included this slide for a couple of reasons. One, I wanted to show you what our staffing level was July 1 of 2008, when we were at 8,472 classified employees. We had about 1,320 employees in our central functions. And I've made a subtle change here. I want you to be very clear about that. We talk about central office, but in reality, central office functions are all over the state. The Virginia Transportation Research Council is technically a central office function, but it is in Charlottesville. So that is why I've changed the terminology that you see here from office to functions. You see the classified field staff at 7,151 and our wage or temporary employee complements, and we only take these in snapshots, at 520. The significance of the September 1st column is that is the benchmark against which I am implementing the blueprint on organization and staffing from the staffing side, so that you can see what the benchmark measurement is. It's 8,464 total classified employees in last September. Today, we are at 8,233. That's telling you, and that's all through hiring freeze and attrition. So it tells you that people are continuing to retire. Our rates are at about 20 to 25 a month. We anticipate and project that in July of this year, we will be, through attrition, at about 8,190 total employees classified. If that were to continue, and the point of this graphic is to show that through attrition alone, by July of 2010, we'd be at about 7,800. That's our best guess, against a target of 7,500, with the mix as you would see it here. We also have implemented and are implementing June 6th the reduction of our wage and temporary workforce, and we announced that last month, as you're all aware, reducing the remaining 232. We will have a staff of wage employees at about 106 across the department, and those are on a review schedule because they were exceptions that were granted for particular purposes as we move forward through the year. We have been, since 2005, actively managing the workforce to move to an organization. A staff ceiling, a 6% vacancy rate below our authorized complement was initiated in 2005. That was done at the time to make room for the consolidation of the area headquarters, which we did in 2006, and help manage that transition. We installed last September a critical hire process and a freeze so that we could manage all the vacancies in the department. That is proving to be very successful. And we have continued to monitor the attrition and retirement trends. What I'm highlighting for you in that slide is, in fact, the three mechanisms that we are using to get to 7,500. But it's a 7,500 of a differently proportioned organization and differently focused organization. So what I've done in this slide is simply show you that no one tool by itself will achieve the goal that we are targeted to achieve. But as we move into implementation in July, all three tools working together will achieve the 7,500 and will get it positioned and get our people positioned where they need to be to achieve the direction of the blueprint, which is an organization focused on maintenance and operations first, construction and program development second. That's a recognition of the change in the business that is going on across the country. So if you look at us in July of 2010, our bulk will be in maintenance and operations, and we will be using different business practices and proportioned differently for construction delivery, project development, and those are the principles that I have briefed the board on prior to this meeting. As we move now into adding that piece called, and the technical term we have to use is involuntary separations, we have adjusted our plan, and we have adjusted it in two respects. First, you can see by these statistics, our wage and staff augmentation implementation, and rather than to then have three stages of reduction within the department, we are collapsing that into two stages. The first would be implemented July with anticipated separation of the identified staff in October. That number will vary. But our estimate at this time is about 450 employees. That number will be adjusted because of the attrition and the retirement that is going on. I have listed for you the functions in stage two, as we call it, that are being focused at. You can see our public affairs group, BRTC, our right-of-way function, equipment shops, location and design, bridge, traffic engineering, environmental, construction, inspection, and materials. Exactly what you would expect with a reduction in the program in the magnitudes that we're dealing with. You will also see in this stage two piece following July a consolidation of several of the divisions, and we'll be able to begin implementing that consolidation from 31 to 22 divisions. For this stage, what you see is our anticipated reductions, spending reductions as a result. I wanted to share that with you in our best estimates at this point with the mix of employees. Our wage and augmented staff services that we're reducing for fiscal year 10, we anticipate about $15 million in reduction, and over the 11th through 14th, because we see these as permanent, they carry forward, so that'll achieve another $60 million in that slice. The estimate around our stage two of classified employee impacts is about $30 million during fiscal year 10 and extended out through 11 through 14, would be about $132 million. There is a note at the bottom of the page, and Ms. Buescher identified that note as a part of her presentation in the budget. There is a cost for workforce transition or severance for those people. Our current estimate for fiscal year 10 would be in the magnitude of $11 to $16 million. So we have reserved that as a part of this process. Beginning in December, you would see then the last stage of the consolidation and the units that would be affected with notification in December, anticipated first quarter or March separation dates, and that would affect potentially another 400 positions. And I've listed, in addition to the Dulles Toll Road, the functions and the groups, the divisions actually, that you would see affected by those changes. Because these reductions would occur late in the year, obviously the salary impact is much less, about $6 million for fiscal year 10, but extended out turns into about $125 million in fiscal years 11 through 14. The plans and the process by which we are dealing with our people, as I have explained at our previous meetings, we have a specifically targeted workforce transition team or people transition team who is managing the process. We have held almost 300 sessions with employees across the Commonwealth, making them aware of what rights, what benefits, what programs, how to plan for this kind of an effect on them. We have tried to maintain communication as frequently as we can to keep them informed of the status. And as we move into the June and July time frame now, the real hard work of specific employee notification, and that starts then a process described in code and by rule, which causes a time frame that takes us out to October for actual separation. That allows for substitution of employees, it allows for job search and placement, all of those services that we provide to our affected employees differently than in a private sector model. And you will verify that if you talk to any of the employees in the department who have worked in the private sector, been affected by workforce involuntary separations, and how that occurs versus the process that we're using in the department. That's our people snapshot as we move forward. The next piece I've got for you to finish off this afternoon deals with where we are with the consolidation and looking at our facilities across the Commonwealth. This is the overhead slide that shows you our fleet of 189 area headquarters is not being affected. They are being maintained and will be fully staffed at the end of the day. We are consolidating and have validated our 44 residency consolidation to 29 or closure. The 73 shops, equipment shops, reduced to 37. A consolidation of our operations center here in the Richmond area, so we'll reduce from 6 to 5. And our materials laboratories being consolidated from 8 to 5 across the Commonwealth. I'll show each of those in detail here in a second. I did want to make one note. You'll see a footnote on your slide that talks a little bit about NOVA. And as you look at our residencies, back in about 2004, the NOVA district implemented a system or a management structure that in fact eliminated their residency structure. And they have been transitioning to that for the last 4 years. So when we talk about 44 to 29, it's really a clarified number. The perhaps more accurate characterization would be from 40 to 29, given the change in the management approach that NOVA has used.
Mr. Chairman, could you explain that a little bit more, what Northern Virginia is actually doing?
Northern Virginia went to a functionalized approach, much like we're talking about for maintenance and operations, back in about the early 2000s, 2003, 2004. Their maintenance engineer directs directly the maintenance operations through their headquarters structure. So they have superintendents in the field. Their residencies, because they were out of the construction business, transitioned away, and they are now using community liaisons more directly. So that's the personal contact piece for each of their counties. So that's why you see the numbers vary a little bit. And it also illustrates for you why we're striving to get a consistent organizational approach within the agency, because as you have differing organizational approaches, it makes it very difficult to respond to either growth or reduction. And so we're trying to stabilize that.
Mr. Chairman, we heard a lot in the hearings about, and this regional thing is always a problem, but we heard a lot of criticism that the plan was not affecting Northern Virginia, but was affecting everybody else. So you're saying, in effect, that there is an answer to that question, even though on paper it appears that there's no reduction in maintenance in residencies or in equipment centers in Northern Virginia, that there really is?
That is correct. But it's a time-sensitive picture, so you get a snapshot.
Because we heard that over and over.
That's absolutely correct. And while I understand the criticism, you will see impacts throughout the department, including Northern Virginia, both on the personnel side and on the facilities side.
I think, too, having been in local government when the residency was closed in Prince William County, it was a tough transition. But essentially, with the commissioners recommending that the rest of the state look more like what occurred a decade ago in Northern Virginia.
Let's see, the residency consolidation, and so what I've tried to give you here now is the final directions that we're pursuing with our residency consolidation. This, again, like the previous slide, was our start. Both from the organizational side, a target organization of 7,500, consolidation of business functions, functionalizing the department, reducing our residency structure by about 30% from current levels. We're expanding span of control for supervisors. And then we evaluated the proposals to ensure that no given residency, which will now have a primary maintenance and operations focus, is balanced by population, lane miles, square miles served, and number of area headquarters managed. So our analysis that we provided previously shows that we maintain as good a balance as we can across that kind of an organizational design. This is the map then that would show you the residencies to be closed. I've highlighted the one change that we are making from the original proposal. It is in the Hampton Roads district, where we have switched the closure from Williamsburg, which was first proposed to close. That will be retained, and Waverly will be closed in place of it. We've tried to give you an estimate in that square on the right-hand side of non-personnel system-wide operating reductions that we think will accumulate as a result in the range of about $1.5 million to $2 million a year. That's all the support functions that go along with those residencies, whether it's utilities or the other kinds of services that we pay for to support any one of those given services. And our first anticipated closings, we believe, will occur around December. Questions on residence. We did have appeals and requests to review two other residency locations. I reviewed those and against the business case analysis, and I could not justify those switches. For your use, this is the detailed list. It gives you not only the district title, but it shows how many residencies they started, how many maintenance areas they will have, and what counties will be served through those maintenance areas. The second area that we will address or deal with this afternoon is then the closure of our equipment shop across the Commonwealth. We have validated that a reduction of 73 to 37 is feasible and can be accomplished. We have driven that through the principles you see here. We are seeing a downsizing of the fleet and equipment needs that was anticipated as a result of outsourcing of the interstate system and better utilization of equipment as it exists within the Commonwealth. So in other words, if you plan better, you can utilize equipment more efficiently. We do make an investment in equipment, and it is good equipment. We try to provide as good equipment as possible to all staff. We have recognized that there are services we can draw on from the private sector to provide some of the services that would normally be done through an internal equipment shop, and we have implemented or will implement fully statewide a mobile operation. You'll hear it referred to as either field mechanics or contact trucks. The criteria that we used was to ensure that we had no equipment shop further than 60 minutes from any given site where we house equipment.
Mr. Chairman, I know you had some discussion about the unique piece of geography that's in the Stanton District, and that is that the three counties west of the mountain, and I noticed that Allegheny will be maintained, but Highland is being closed as far as equipment shops, and to get from Allegheny to Highland is a huge challenge, and I know you had some discussion about that. Do you feel comfortable at this point that you can cover geography with this equipment issue because of the mountainous terrain that's between those two locations?
Mr. Chairman, very frankly, I do. I've been in the business for 43 years. I know the success of a contact truck system, and I understand, and I think the district is maintaining a contact truck to serve that area. So that okay. That covers that piece, because we did have that specific discussion.
Thank you.
Could you describe the contact truck for those who may not be familiar with the concept?
Essentially, it changes from you have to bring the problem to your shop, as we do with our cars, to where you'll see our staff, and across the Commonwealth, you see this already, have trucks outfitted with all the tools they need to repair a truck in the field, short of probably removing and replacing an engine or a transmission. With the communication systems that we are fully implementing across the Commonwealth, two-way radios, cell phones, all the tools that are available to us now, it's very common to see, at least in my experience, that contact truck operator or that field mechanic routinely visiting each of the area headquarters that they serve, catching all the problems they need to do, doing the preventive maintenance checks that need to occur. And if there is a major problem, then you utilize one of your 37 shops and haul your equipment into that shop for a major repair.
Mr. Chairman? Commissioner, is it just coincidence that there seems to be this one-to-one relationship between a number of pieces of equipment and a number of employees? Or is that...
Is that the same question you're going to ask me about how many computers have I got? Because if you count my computers, I've got two computers for every employee, too.
Yeah.
It's not a fair way to count.
No, I saw it's not in your criteria.
I apologize
but it's just,
for the crassness of the answer.
Yeah, no, I'm with you.
And the map that you see is...
But, I would add, Commissioner, unfortunately, have a little bit of history here, but the goal at one time was to have VDOT as a 14,000-person organization, and that was not so very long ago. So there was a whole complement of equipment, of facilities. The world was different not very long ago. And this is the change that we're seeing in the automobile industry and virtually every other sector is affecting transportation departments, not just here, but across the country.
I think you'll also see, if it isn't prevalent across the Commonwealth, services that we got out of the business of when I was running in Minnesota. Instead of trying to change tires ourselves, there are local services that spring up that will service a vehicle very quickly and on-demand focus. So it clearly shows a lighter, more agile, and rapid deployed VDOT as you deal with maintenance and operations. I think the Secretary's point is well made. To be effective in maintenance and operations doesn't mean you have to be heavy in maintenance and operations. This map is used just to illustrate where the equipment shops that are closing are located and the ones that will remain open for your reference. The last slide I've got here deals with the labs and the Transportation Operations Center so that you get a sense of where we're at in terms of the locations for our TOCs. First, you'll see on the list, that will be the five locations that will have high-tech operations centers located. The consolidation is taking the current room that is here in central office and consolidating it at the Richmond facility down in Chester. That's a very quick and easy transition to make. The technology is there, so it's a function of moving people and establishing some revised procedures. So we'll have that implemented the 1st of July. The current lab locations that will remain open, you see all eight listed, and you see the five that have been recommended for retention. We think the accumulated savings for the reductions from consolidation of the TOCs is about non-salary related is about $700,000 annually. I apologize because I have one more statistic. I think, and I hate to do this off the top of my head, so I shouldn't, but I will. These reductions taken in totality, salaries plus operational cost reductions for fiscal year 10, amount to about $38 million. Extended through 11 through 14, that will rise to about $300 million overall. So you can see that we are, this is not a trivial exercise as you do this consolidation and reduction in force. Final piece is, again, where I started this afternoon. The plan's going to adjust some as we move forward. But as I said in January and February, as we move from concept to reality, this is not unlike a design-build project. You know what you want at the end. You don't have all the details done before you let the bids, and you do it as you move through it. So consequently, that analogy has caused both frustration, but it also adapts and allows us to be flexible as we learn through the transition. We will implement the plan over the next 12 months, and again, as I said, no function, no activity in the department remains off the table. And every day I'm hearing something different, or I'll get a new piece of analysis that may affect what we're doing. With that, I'll stand for questions. I appreciate this has been a lengthy presentation for you. I know it's a lot of material to cover, but there's an awful lot of work that has gone into this from an awful lot of people in the department. So I appreciate your patience this afternoon.
Okay, thank you again, Commissioner. If you could go back to one of the early slides just to help us through this, slide five, which is the outlook by program, I think will help. Before we get to going around the table and asking for conversations, are there any questions of the Commissioner to clarify his recommendations, to understand that? Ms. Coolmate.
Mr. Chairman, Commissioner, all this organizational and staffing expenditure is within that $184.5 million that Rita Buescher told us is general administration?
No, that's why I said early on, as you look at this slide, there's not a one-to-one good correlation. Some of it is embedded in the construction program. Some of it is embedded in traditional administration. Some of it is embedded in maintenance. So there's no easy way to go through and target it for you, because obviously if I'm saving $300 million on a $184 million administration budget, I've overcorrected, and that's not the way it works. Sorry about that.
Yeah. So that does make it difficult for us to make up. For you to speak and for us to make an independent judgment of sort of the relative costs of labor and staffing and organizational versus the service that is actually attached to.
That's correct.
But that wasn't on purpose.
Okay. Okay.
Quick question. Of the rest areas that are going to be closed, how many are modern, how many are antiquated?
We have closed no modern rest areas. That's the only thing I can guarantee you. In other words, when we screened and made sure that of the 19 we're recommending, we had not just invested mega-millions of dollars to renovate it. That is not, all of them are the older facilities.
Well, that's not really answering my question. How many of them need to be redone?
Oh.
If we had the capability.
How many would you like to redo?
Three. And the rest of them are in good shape, bad shape.
The majority, the ones that are supposed to remain open, are in pretty exceptional shape. The only one that is on the capital, long-term capital replacement program, supposed to remain open, is Skipper's.
Where I'm going with this is there are some that I remember ought to be closed. Mm-hmm. And I'm trying to figure if that's what we're closing, or if we're closing some that are in that we're proud of.
I think, Mr. Dickens, the criteria that some of the criteria that informed the commissioner's recommendation were age of the facility. So the older ones were more likely to be recommended for closure, and certainly none of the reconstructed ones in there.
Yeah, there were also about
Are there any remodeled facilities from that $22 million or general fund money that the General Assembly that are recommended for closure?
Yes.
One. I think there's one.
Six. Six of the smaller facilities that we chose.
Jay, can you come on up and introduce yourself?
I can get the question repeated, so I'll make sure I answer.
I think the question was, were any of the remodeled facilities included in the 19 that are recommended for closure?
Yes, sir. Six.
Okay.
And those capital costs were less than $3 million out of that $22 million.
Total.
There was $22 million. There was $20 million that the General Assembly provided, mm-hmm. if I remember correctly, and we rebuilt three facilities with that, and there was a small amount of money that we put with money that we had already in the program that went toward remodeling. So my concern was we were kind of answering two different questions.
The rebuilt facilities all would stay in place. There are six that have undergone some renovation over the last couple of years that are recommended for closure here.
Yes, sir.
And one welcome center in Manassas is recommended for closure. Okay, if we might, what I'd like to do is just point out the pie chart, and I know the hour is late, but this is a very important discussion. And if you can look at that pie chart, you know, in the blue is the 72% that comes from the construction program. And one of the things that people say, well, gosh, maybe we can take a little bit more out of there. We are so finely tuned there, if you take a dollar of state funds out of there, you're going to lose the four federal dollars matching. So we are limited to the 28% that is described as admin and support programs and the maintenance programs for these cuts. In round numbers, on an annual basis, we're getting $300 million a year, roughly, out of the construction program, about $100 million a year in the smaller slices of the pie. So what we and the commissioner has recommended is a budget that does that. So that needs to be the focus of our discussions. And I'd like to just read to you an email just came across this afternoon from ASHTO. And one of the things that needs to be in the back of people's minds, which is what our chief financial officer has just told us, which is that we're 2% below the revenue forecast that are driving these cuts as of today. And it says, the U.S. Department of Transportation has begun briefing congressional committees on the coming cash shortfall in the highway account of the Highway Trust Fund. According to congressional staff, USDOT staff have begun informing Congress that a cash shortage may force a notification to states of a slowdown in payments from the highway account as early as August. The shortfall could be as much as $4 billion, according to DOT. And if Congress is to address maintaining the trust fund solvency through fiscal year 2010, it could require as much as an additional $13 billion. Now, you may recall last summer there was a one-time fix of $8 billion just to maintain current funding levels. What they're now talking about is a $13 billion infusion just to maintain that. So what we have to do here is to make some hard choices, but also to be prepared for additional cuts. So that's one of the reasons that Ms. Buescher has put a federal revenue reserve in the event that they yank something back. We're somewhat prepared for that. But at $13 billion, you're looking at about a 35% cut in federal revenues if that does not occur. We have the same dynamic occurring with the state transportation trust fund. Again, let's go back to what we're based on. Gas taxes, motor vehicle sales, and insurance premiums that are based on the value of a car and a home. So we are not well positioned here, and as the commissioner indicated, this is another step in a journey. We're getting there a lot faster, I think, than any of us would like, but we also have to prepare to keep going down this path of continuing shrinkage. That said, we're going to be voting next June, and so I'm going to start this end of the table, and let's just go around and please share with staff and your colleagues here on the board some thoughts on this budget and how we get to this very important set of budget decisions, and recognizing, you know, that we've got clearly established priorities, first of safety and then of asset preservation, and after that things kind of fall into place. Mr. Dickens.
Well, thank you, sir. I'll try not to say a whole lot, saving room for others to speak. I want to suggest that the staff has done a marvelous job, I think, of working in a very difficult environment. I'm most impressed with the opportunities they've afforded the public to make comments, and the reactions that have been made in recognition of public comment. I don't like these cuts, but I don't see that we have a choice. I would like to see some of these things stay. I really appreciate the ferry staying. I would like to see some of the rest areas stay. Having said that, I don't know how we do it.
Thank you. Mr. Schwartz.
It's really hard to react to it. I don't know whether these are all the right trade-offs and the right decisions, but a heck of a lot of work's gone into it, and I'm prepared to accept it as the best shot at addressing a very serious problem. So I'm prepared to go with it.
Ms. Carter?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Of course, coming to this job, it, to me, it was to be a servant. And here I am, a servant a little maiden servant with those funding. And that's hard, very, very hard. The rest areas are certainly a large concern that I have. And when I read and it said they would be boarded up, that would be terrible. That would look terrible in Virginia. Our state is a beautiful state. And as we state, keep our Commonwealth, Virginia, spotless. And that's what we want. But if we, I don't know what procedure that we would use, but to board them up and to have those who would just love to go and write on boards confetti and whatever they wanted to do, I hope that we can do something to help that situation. And yes, employees are dear to our heart. And they say, well, we want the economy to build, and so some of us received some checks. Yes, we did, and that was good. But when we have to lay off people, how are we going to build the economy? And we talk about if they have time to search, where they're going to search. Searching has almost been deleted. There is hardly any search out there. It's critical. And I believe that you stated, I'd like to ask Mr. Eckern a question, that there are 20 to 25 of that are retiring a month. That helps me some, because I am concerned about those who are losing their jobs. How do they feed their family? How do they put that loaf of bread on the table? How do they do that? Let's just say it. But we can do no more than what we have funds for. We cannot allocate, even at home, if we don't have funds to pay our bills, what do we do? They have to go. And if people don't have money to put a loaf of bread or a gallon of milk on the table for their children, what do they do? And it's a sad time. And VDOT has always delivered, I believe, the best service that anyone could ask for. And I'm proud of Virginia for that. And and I believe they're going to continue to do that. But it's going to be something that's going to be very hard for those who are employees to accept, and for us to accept that that will happen. And when we talk about the ferries, yes, in the Northern Neck, there are ferries that are going to be affected by this. But I'm very happy to say that the hours have been evaluated, and that the hours of service, I believe, will still serve them. When we speak of the ferries, we are also speaking about transit. When we speak about buses, many of these people use ferries for their transportation. And this is just as important to them as we talk about a bus for our city in Fredericksburg or Richmond or wherever. So but I do commend staff. They have done everything I believe that they can possibly do. And I'm hoping that the General Assembly members will take hope now, and maybe they'll see that some way we have got to do something different in Virginia so that we can serve our citizens of the Commonwealth. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Witt?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Commissioner, you've done a good job, you and your staff, and provided a lot of information. I probably don't have yet enough information in order to pass judgment on whether we're doing the right thing. I'm going to sound like a broken record. We are at the tipping point. When I joined you all 4 years ago, our pavement was substandard by 18%, and it's been growing at a percent or more per year, and at a blink of an eye, we're going to be at 25%. Our chief engineer got my attention about bridges a number of years ago, and Ms. Bishop today on a slide said that we will need $3.7 billion to replace all the currently deficient bridges, but a year and a half year and a half ago, we heard that had a slide that sort of said, if you extrapolate at our current replacement rate, it would take over 125 years to replace all the bridges and culverts in Virginia. And I would argue that most of them were not built to have a 125-year life. Whether we like it or not, we have been relegated to the maintenance business. I know that Dr. Davis and I probably disagree greatly on this. But I can't see from this blueprint how we are adequately planning for the future. We're making cuts today in order to make the budget balance, but I'm unclear as to where we're going. We should be upset. We've been given a job to do, and the General Assembly has not given us anywhere near the required resources to do that job. Nobody likes where we are. No one likes to see a stagnant program or one that doesn't look forward to the future, but we have to deal with reality. And if I've learned anything in the last 4 years, is that hope is not a strategy and new money is not forthcoming, and we have to get our hands around what we want to do. Mr. Chairman, you said in July we're going to hear about new goals or standards for pavement or well, when it comes to adopting this budget, this is part of the information that I feel that I'm missing today. I don't know what to cut today in order to prepare our organization for tomorrow. At what rate are we going to be able to sustain pavement or repair these bridges? And we talked about the ferry. If we don't get that money for that $30 million ferry, I'll tell you, if I was going to spend $30 million on a boat, it would look a lot better than that. But, you know,
it wouldn't carry cars.
Get a better look at one, I guess.
If we don't get that money, this is just a delay problem. Those folks coming from Surrey and Isle of Wight are not going to be able to get across that river because we're not going to have a water transportation vehicle that's going to take them there. I know that we're all sensitive to people and their jobs, and no one likes to utter the words that more jobs could possibly be cut. I mean, no matter where you are in management or oversight of an organization, those are things you want to talk about. But our construction budget 4 years ago was $8.6 billion, and we saw today now it's $5.4, and I would argue even with the abatement of some of the construction costs, there still has been inflation over that period of time, and in fact, with the $5.4 billion, we can only do half of what we were able to do with $8.6 billion. You know, 4 years ago, we've cut our staff from 10,500 to 7,500. But you know, the bean counter says if you're doing half the program, you haven't cut half your staff. Now, we're not doing half the program. We're switching. We're not doing construction. We need to be a maintenance organization. But again, Mr. Commissioner, I'm not sure I understand the model of the organization and how many people we need to do what our new mission needs to be. And you've outlined the blueprint, but I'm not there yet. I can't get my hands around this. And I think as different of my colleagues mentioned it, they're not going to like this cut or that cut. But I don't think we're sitting here with a comprehensive vision as to where we need to be so that we can either give thumbs up or thumbs down to what's appropriate to do. These cuts meet our needs for this year, but they don't lay out the blueprint enough for where the organization needs to go. Thanks.
And I think a great deal of that work has been done by Dr. Allen and the commissioner's staff. I think there's a lot of detail, and we can talk about how to get that out electronically to the board members. So I think at least when you talk about the staffing complement, if we're all maintenance, essentially what does that look like? And I think also, too, if the focus is on that the construction program increasingly is about bridges and bridge replacement, which if you stand back and look at it, there's a whole lot of it that is like that. Mr. Keene.
Well, having personally, having in the past to implement workforce reductions, even in large numbers, as much as 600. I don't envy the staff and what they face in terms of facing the people they've got to give a pink slip to. And I know there's a transition type program in place, and we need to have patience with that and do everything we can to make that a smooth transition. And it wouldn't be wrong to remind the people, even the ones that are going to be eliminated, that there have been attempts over the last 8 years to raise revenues. And the fact that we're in this downturn in the economy is not the main reason that we're having to do such a drastic reductions to the program. We would have this problem if we didn't have, even if we didn't have this downturn in the economy. And so there have been attempts to alleviate it early on. In addition to that, you very well remember there have been attempts in the General Assembly to change the funding formula for the distribution of funds and transportation, and that's failed every time. But we're going to turn around as CTB and basically do some of that through the drafting of and the developing of road categories that will have priorities. And that will begin to shift maintenance funds to areas where the state where they definitely need it. But it will also drain it from rural Virginia to get it to the urban areas with these road categories. And we're going to maintain the 20,000 miles. By and large, the 37, I guess it's left, exist in rural Virginia. And they're going to be found in the categories of 3, 4s, and 5s primarily, which will not get very much money for maintenance. So we're basically going to do for them the things that they couldn't pass in the legislature is look at a redistribution of money to maintain the roads on what money we've got, even though it's a reduced pie. We're going to see larger portions of it go into that 85% region, which I feel like is really where we need to look at this plan and make some adjustments and put some floor on the maintenance money that needs to go to some of the counties and some of these lower categories of roads. It's really a devastating. It's not intended. It's a loss of revenue. It's devastation to areas that cannot help themselves and cannot are already hurting. So my appeal would be, as we look to make adjustments to the blueprint, is that we've got to make that change.
Hmm.
Mr. White?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is tough stuff, and many of us have been involved in this, and the private sector is sitting on boards, and some of us have been involved in the public sector and sitting on local boards of supervisors and so forth. I commended the commissioner back when he first rolled out his initial set of proposals, because this is tough stuff, and it showed a lot of leadership on his part and on the part of his staff. And I have admired the way, at least in the public hearing I attended, the commissioner handled all the individual concerns of citizens. In my district, once I have sat down with people that had initial concerns about closing of equipment repair facilities and residences, once we've talked it through, I found that folks pretty well accepted what we were doing. Now, in terms of rest areas and ferries, I don't have any of those in my district. And so I have to defer to my colleagues on the board that do have those facilities and have been close to the citizens' concerns that have been voiced to them. But maybe that lets me look at it a little bit more objectively, since I don't have any of those concerns in my district. I sit here and look at the proposed cuts to the ferry services, and the amount of money that's to be saved there is peanuts. It's $75,000 in one instance and $75,000 in another, and I think $21,000 in another. There's no way for me to evaluate whether the value of those savings offsets the cutting of the services. I just can't do that. And so I've got to rely on my friends from the Hampton Roads area, and I think there's one in the Culpeper District as well, for them to respond to. The rest areas, I'm in the same boat. 127 miles apart sounds reasonable to me. But I've got to say, with all due respect, having complimented the commissioner and his staff, I've never seen in my 40 years a budget of $3.5 billion where you couldn't find $9 or $10 million to deal with some of the concerns that members of the board have expressed. Now, you know, in the final analysis, I will support the budget as it turns out to be, but those are my honest, objective as I can be, comments at this point, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Mr. Davey.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to join in commending the commissioner. I think he has continued what was started through attrition with Georgia Tech, but he has refined it, and he's had a tougher job because it's no longer just attrition. It's having to directly take the scalpel to the muscle, and that becomes a challenge. One of the things that I've heard the most frequently is the concern that by taking that scalpel to the muscle, we are going to deliver less service, and the citizens of Virginia are going to be less well served. And that's going to be a real challenge. We have the determination that we're going to get this done. Well, we may get it done, but it also carries with it some fairly significant risk, both in terms of credibility the one thing that I've learned to watch as I've gone through this process, quite frankly, is what the legislature does when it doesn't like what the Commonwealth Transportation Board does, is it simply intervenes and takes other action. I am concerned that what we are about to do with the rest areas is to tread into that territory. And I think there is some benefit to taking a step back and doing what Jim Davis mentioned, taking a look at it, especially if there are rest areas that the legislature has money that it has invested in rehabilitation, and we're about to close six of those facilities. I think we need to give that some additional thought as we work through the process. One of the other things, I guess, that I've given some thought to, I've been trying to talk to some of the local government folks in my region, and there is a concern that the seniority rule that we have is going to be implemented, and there are going to be people who they have developed working relationships with who have a very strong work ethic, who may be younger, who may not be the ones, because of seniority, who are left in the positions of responsibility. And they are concerned that through the process, there may be individuals left in place who represent the old guard, who are not going to be responsive, and we're not going to get that shared vision of the future. And I'm hearing that now repeated, and it's getting enough credence that I'm getting calls from local government folks saying, listen, I understand this is going to be an issue. You need to pay attention to it. You know, we have to deal with it. You all ought to look at this. My assurance to them is that I'm sure that the district administrators are communicating with the commission on that issue, and it's not one that we necessarily need to be involved with, but it's one we're going to hear about. And one other point that I've made a couple of times, and that is, if we're looking at closing facilities and we are looking at having vacant facilities, we ought to be considering now the utilization of those properties or how we're going to deal with them. One of the things that we don't want to have happen is to have them become community eyesores, because they're going to be our eyesores. We need to look at the utilization of those structures. It's amazing how, as this progress is made, and I'll use the example in Orange, they're closing the shop. Well, the shop is directly across from the school, the chair of the school board calls me and says, listen, we need an automobile facility for our schools. Can we lease it from VDOT? Can we buy it from VDOT? It's a very small example of an asset that we have that we can turn back into community use, and we ought to be looking at that wherever we have facilities. The other thing that I think is important is that we make sure that we, as we stop using facilities, we may want to look at alternate uses. It may not be just beneficial to simply cut utilities and close them. We may have other purposes. I'm sure district administrators will be looking at that. But my point is, as we're doing all this, we haven't had very much discussion about our inventory of properties, their location, their value, and their reuse. And I think that ought to be a part of what we're really doing, or at least the next phase of what we're doing with this project.
Thank you, Ms.
Connie. I would say listen to this wise person. I think he's made some very good points, and I'll be very brief. But I find the things that I've heard today, the two things that disturb me a great deal are the reverting to prior to my tenure on the board, when we were funding the local maintenance at 3%, and we did raise it to a much more realistic, probably not even adequate, but a 4% figure. And it really, I think it's a step backwards that we're having to compromise and move back to a 3%. And the second one is I'm a twofer. I'm a female and I'm elderly. And there are two areas in which I think that that population cohort needs to be recognized. And one is the safety patrol standards that apparently we're moving back to a 2001 service level. I think that's it may be absolutely necessary, but it is going to impact the elderly, and also women, I think, more than men in the safety service area, and also the rest stops. That has an implication there for particularly at our public hearing. I heard a couple of people talking about the handicapped and their use of the rest areas, and all of ours, I think, are handicapped accessible, and I think that's a value that does need to be considered. So those are my comments. It's very worrisome to be moving backwards, and although I appreciate the constraints and the context in which these decisions are set.
It's an ill wind that blows no good. I can envision some of these organizational changes affecting a better organization, a more efficient organization, one that can get along better in the future, and hopefully in the future we'll have better revenues and better opportunities to do the things that need to be done. But it may be in the long run that these changes that were necessitated by the lack of money might turn out to be a good thing. Sometimes I feel like Southwest Virginia is treated like a red-headed stepchild, and I'm sure that all of us have things we want for our district that are not there. But like, we're getting a $38 million cut from 09 to 10, whereas Northern Virginia is getting a $32 million increase in that same period of time. I feel that a real disappointment that we were unable to cut from six residencies to four in our district rather than six to three. We now have every residency, including four counties, which are geographically, space-wise, very, very big counties. And I can't help but feel that that is a mistake. But, you know, I'm looking at it from my perspective, and each one of us look at it from our own perspective. If we had said, okay, members of the Transportation Board, you come up with a plan, we'd have 16 different plans. None of them would be perfect. None of us would like all of it, and probably none of us like any one plan, just as all of us are not going to like everything about the commissioner's plan. But he knows what he's doing, and I don't. I yield to his expertise, and somebody had to do it. It's absolutely necessary that these changes be made. And I commend the commissioner and all of the staff that had an involvement in it. I think they've done as good a job as could have been done under these very difficult circumstances.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As a couple of our colleagues have already pointed out, this is not easy, but that's why we earn the big bucks, I guess, on this board. It is ultimately our responsibility to take the commissioner's recommendations and try to deal as constructively as we can with them. I commend him and his staff, as always, for being very professional, very thorough. But they're certainly not perfect, and I think there is enough wisdom around this table. That is what we're here for, to provide policy advice. I don't want to run the VDOT for him. I wouldn't pretend to know how to. But I look at the changes he's proposing in a slightly different way, and I'm going to ask that he and his staff give this some consideration. When he talks about the cuts in services, such as the rest areas and the mowing and other things, and then internal cuts, I see these as two distinctly different types of services that he is being forced to deal with. In the broadest categories, there are two. One has to do with internal services, such as, for example, fees or monies paid to VITA. Others have to do with external services, such as things that serve the traveling public, such as rest areas. To say that those are both services that need to be cut misses, to me, a very important distinction about who they actually serve. And so I'm going to ask that they go back and look carefully at balancing the internal service cuts and the external ones with a bias towards serving the external traveling public. As Ken White pointed out, and as I think I said earlier, $9 million is not even a rounding error in our budget, and yet that's what it would cost to close the 19 rest areas, of which six, by the way, are in the District of Richmond. You asked the effect on the district. Well, there's one. We're taking a pretty good hit, although I'm not saying that they couldn't be dispensed with, but one of them between the North Carolina line and the mountains on one side and Fredericksburg on the other side does not seem to be unreasonable to me, to the traveling public. However, my bigger point is look at the difference between what you have to live with internally and perhaps look there first. Versus, and I don't mean people. We're already doing enough damage there. I don't want to see one other person have to lose a job. But I mean these other services, $68 million a year for VITA. That seems on its face a target of opportunity. The fencing, the repairs, that sort of stuff might be another opportunity. The difference between what serves the internal operation and what serves the public. That, to me, is a very important distinction, and I hope you will look at that. Perhaps it might be possible to consider delaying this till January 1st. Maybe by then we'll know if there's going to be federal movement on privatizing the rest areas or giving us permission to do that. It would also be better time to get maximum exposure for the effects of these cuts on the people who most need to see the effects of these cuts, the real decision makers when it comes to that side of things. And I will say it is encouraging to know that some localities have called in their General Assembly delegations and told them point blank that it's time to quit fooling around and raise the gas tax. I mean, a dime a day or less, we wouldn't be talking about this at all. It's absolutely ridiculous that we find ourselves in a situation where we are literally cutting out the people's ability to use rest facilities because we cannot raise a rather insignificant amount of money over the next few years to pay for maintenance of those kinds of services. So I could go on and on, but we got plenty of other people who need to talk, and I'll stop. But I do think the important thing is look at what we're doing to the public and look at what we might be able to do internally in the way of services, the way we run the operation. There is bound to be some savings there, and I hope that we can do that.
I've a number of times talked to the public about this board, my colleagues here being, the term I use is non-geocentric. And I'm just going by what comes out of your mouth. I don't know what's in your heart. But I feel as if we, as a group, collectively look out for the best interest of the state as well as the best interest of our districts. And Gerald, if it was easy, anybody could do it, you know. And that's the situation that we find ourselves in now. Speaking as the representative of Salem District, for example, the ARRA decisions are there. I'm happy we got to share in the pavement and got to share in the enhancement. Would the county like to see us get some construction money? Martinsville, Henry County is the poster child for economically distressed. But at least now I'm glad I understand what happened to the money for I-73 that was non-earmarked with the interstates. So nothing is going to be perfect. There are things I like for my district, things I would rather have gone differently for my district. One of the things in a maxim in business that I've always, well, since I found out it was true, I've always been a proponent. The one who is actually closest to the work doing it is the one who best knows how a job should be done. And I'm thinking on two levels that the blueprint is going to force that upon VDOT. And I would encourage you just go ahead and acknowledge that right now. And I've seen no evidence to the contrary. And just start out understanding a new way of doing business. The one who's closest to it knows best how it ought to be done. For us, that is symptomatic, and we will also have to keep that in mind, for example, with the localities now, decisions that they used to get to do. We are going to have to do extra work, make extra effort, that we practice that same principle in understanding what the one who no longer gets to do it really knows that we don't know, and bring that knowledge and perspective back to help us make sure we make the right decisions and help other people make the right decisions. The one who's closest to it is the one who is going to know best how it ought to be done. The rest areas, at least a bit, justify my defense of VDOT and the administration when people were making, you know, they were saying some awful things. I don't know what your emails look like, but you know, now I can go back and say, see, we can be reasonable and flexible and figure out a better way to do things. Well, that can't be a one-time event. Reality is changing on us. Reality has changed. And no one entity is going to be the one that's always correct. So, actually, all this comes down to, and you all know it, you said it a lot, Gerald has said it more eloquently and frequently, but what we're looking at is the collision between political will and public wood. The political will is to, say, privatize the rest areas. The public would use all the rest areas and keep them open. The public would use the SS, the safety service patrols, and be glad they're there. The political will is to not fund them because it means finding revenue. The public would have a residency in every county. The political will is to audit VDOT to look for inefficiencies. The public would vote against taxes. The political will is to pander to that.
the public would also reward someone who came with sound, logical, and fair solutions, and then more importantly, communicated those solutions to the public and to the legislators. The political will is to not do that much work or not take those chances. That's the reality that is here. So it might be time for us to just get all the way out of the box, down under the table or up on top of the table, but to determine what is going to be the new paradigm and start promoting that new paradigm based on what we've got to work with, unless we can find a way to change what we have to work with.
Thank you. Dr. Davis, we're ready for it.
Well, I apologize a little bit for my combative nature, but it's all done in good spirit, and I do want you to know my respect for my colleagues and the secretary and the commissioner and all the staff. I offer my full support for the majority of this plan and have taken my hits from members of the General Assembly and from entire boards of supervisors when I have supported closing residencies and a number of other things. And I will continue to do that because I believe that we have to honor our commitment to have a balanced budget and to live within the means that are given to us. That does not mean, however, I or you have to be happy about that. And we should be expressing our opinions forcibly and regularly to the broader constituencies that we're not happy with the position we're put in. And I hope we can organize to do that more effectively. The one thing that still troubles me in all of this is that I really believe there is not a sound plan for the closing of these rest areas that we can live with. And I think it needs to be delayed, and we need to have that plan. And I will support closing a number of these rest areas and revising their purpose, because the secretary made me quite aware that these rest areas were built for a different day and a different reason. I hadn't thought about it in those terms. But they've come to be very important to a lot of constituencies who feel very strongly that if we take them away, that we're doing a disservice to them. And they don't relate the business of paying taxes as being related to the closure, and we will do great harm to VDOT and to the people who do public service by closing them without a good, clear plan for why and what we're going to do with them. Because we cannot board up or put up simple barriers for these facilities along 81, 95, even 85, even though it may not be as pretty as 81 or some of the other areas. We can't do that. And it's going to cost money. I mean, the commissioner and I talked about this. It's going to be $25 or $30 million just to tear down the buildings and clean up the areas. Where is that coming from? We can't not have that plan and know how we're going to implement it. So I really hope we will delay for some period of time closing these rest areas to come up with that plan and to figure out how to take it out of another area with it doing minimal damage to any other area so that we can do it right. And I thank all of you for your patience in listening to me on this, but I got an earful many times on it, and I think it's important that I share with you just how much I've heard about this issue from people across the Commonwealth, and especially people who travel the interstates. So that you'll be as sensitive to it, perhaps, as I have become. So I thank you for your patience in listening to me.
Ms. Coolmate?
Some years ago, the columnist Ellen Goodman, who some of you may know, was turned 40 years old, and one of her friends said, "Wow, you don't look 40." And she said, "Honey, this is what 40 looks like." Well, you know, there's a certain amount of activity here that's, it's one thing to be unresponsive, it's another thing to be irresponsible, even negligent, and I think probably that's where we are. This blueprint begins to show the General Assembly this is what your decisions really look like. The decisions, the irresponsible decisions, and the neglect of the last 6 years in particular, looks like this. It looks like rest areas, it looks like safety patrols, it looks like mowing. It also looks like layoffs. It looks like no construction budget. It looks like our inability to keep our promises and our obligations on transportation to ourselves, to localities, to the traveling public. I sympathize with your comments, Dr. Davis, but the fact is, in the hearing in Northern Virginia, there were three big constituencies that were worried about the rest areas. There were truckers, there were tourism people, and there were travelers. Not one of them offered any alternative to what was being proposed. Nobody said, I'd be willing to pay something more. They wanted something for free because they've been promised that that's what they can have. I'm saying this in general. We're not talking about change now. We're talking about a transformation of our system. And I think you've got your finger on it. I think it's difficult to admit that, but we're not just changing some things. VDOT is not just going to be smaller and yet still the same shape. Our mission is changing. Our responsibility as a board are changing, and they're changing these ways. If you move to maintenance and operations as first, increasingly those are decisions that are made by technical requirements. They involve quantifiable measurements of where you make investments and why, and the return on those investments. And with all due respect for my colleague from Bristol, it has nothing to do with equity to each of us as board members. It has to do with science and facts and technology and applications that shouldn't be in a room to be divided up in a political fashion. That diminishes our role as the CTB. You know, the decisions we make about construction or about corridors, those are bigger decisions. Those are what's a vision of the future decisions. Maintenance and operations are not those kinds of decisions. So, you know, one of the things I'm looking at is we ought to revisit our role as the board and even the size as a board. You know, this board is too big if we're just going to administer a maintenance and operations budget. Let's have four members from four districts and four members at large, and that's probably enough to do the job. Let's look at the way we conduct our business. Let's look at the way that the board is expected to interface with the constituencies and with the people of Virginia. I mean, those are what transformation really involves, not fiddling around the edges. And I think too many of us are still stuck fiddling around the edges. Alan Witt has said it more directly than anybody else, and that's really what we're faced with. Now, I applaud the work of the commissioner and of the department. Extraordinary good work. I think it's by establishing standards, criteria, quantifiable results in each of these areas, by taking it to the public and hearing really what the public had to say, I think we're on very solid ground. But the fact is, going forward, VDOT's not going to be the same shape. It's not going to be able to perform the same set of functions. And until the General Assembly sees the consequences of its inactions, it will not make the changes that are necessary. Its answer is to cut and paste around the edges. Because here's the other part of transformation. The way the system's set up is what economists call a steady state. Gradually increasing revenues each year will match gradually increasing needs each year. Well, that hasn't been the case here in transportation for two decades. The fact is, Northern Virginia is suffering not just from maintenance and operational deficiencies. We need more capacity. But you look at this plan and the budget we're talking about today, there's no money for new capacity. It's the same set of questions that the commissioner faced on people. You can't just reduce the numbers because you don't have the right people in the right places doing the right things. Right now in Virginia, we don't have the right transportation infrastructure in the right places doing the right things, but we have no capacity to move it. We're stuck 15 years ago. Now, I don't mean that we're not making improvements. I don't mean that we're not trying hard, and I don't mean that the money we've appropriated in the last few years hasn't been used wisely or well. The fact is, if we can't complete our networks, we don't really get the benefit of those improvements. If we can only do a segment of a highway and not the whole highway, we can't get the capacity improvements that we need. If we can't add the interchanges, if we can't keep the bridges open, and so forth. So, you know, my conclusion is we're on the right track. I would like to see us be even more draconian in the way we attack this, anticipate not just a little bit of a reduction in federal funds, but a lot. Anticipate absolutely no remedial action by the General Assembly, and really look at how we cut all this down and really be honest about it. Okay, that's a lot of points all at once. Specifically, I think the rest area methodology is very good, and I don't support any delay in those changes. I think the methodology on the maintenance of roadways and so forth is solid, even down to the turf grass. I was impressed with that. I would like a little more information myself about some of the cross-agency agreements that we have with DMV, the state police, because I do think that those need to be renegotiated and in some way. VITA, I understand a little bit more because I was involved a little bit when it was created, and I understand that a large part of the savings people anticipate by doing it themselves is basically not paying for seat licenses for all your people, not really using security or software that protects the system. And so you cut corners so you can save money, like we all do at home with our own computers. Probably no virus will get me. But on those other things, that has to be a part of a larger conversation, because what we see is this platform that we have just isn't strong enough to support all these services. And quite frankly, you know, if tourism wants welcome centers and so forth, and that's a tourist function, there ought to be a way that tourism pays for it. The same way with the trucks, if they want additional parking spaces, you know, there's no reason they can't add that $1,834 in taxes paid to be $1,854 paid. I mean, that's not going to make or break their businesses. And then finally, people need to be honestly told that if you value something, you have to pay for it. And through this process, very complex of tip, sip, slip, rip, I mean, it's too complex. There's too many little hidden ball tricks, and we just need to be much more honest about this. In conclusion, I'll just say I think you have been, Mr. Secretary. I think you have been, Mr. Commissioner. And I think, as colleagues, I think we all have been. So that's our strength. Tell it straight. Let the chips fall where they may. And if those with the power to make a change decide to do it, they will. If they don't, well, they need to understand the consequences. Because, honey, this is what it looks like.
Last words, Mr. Sterling.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a very long and eloquent speech prepared, but given that the hour is late, nobody wants to hear it, and much of it's been said before, let me just see if I can summarize where we essentially are. There are a lot of wants in transportation. There's a smaller subset, which are needs, and yet there's a smaller subset still, which is that which we can afford. We are in the unfortunate position not of being able to decide what of the wants we're going to fund, but what of the needs we're not going to fund. That's where we are today. That's where we've been for recent history. I'm not omniscient. If I were, I'd probably come up with a different package than what we have before us, but I'll bet it wouldn't be that much different. It was put together, as Mr. Schwartz said, with a lot of time, a lot of energy, as others have said. I will be the first to say that should an amendment be proposed, I will fairly evaluate it. I will vote according to what I think the merits of that amendment should be, what the highest priorities should be. But I think it's going to be a very, very steep hill to climb to be able to make a lot of changes. There are things in here, again, that I'd want. There are things that we need. But do we need them as much as we need some of the others? This isn't a case of making decisions on what will propel us further ahead, what will put us in the best position for the future necessarily, but we're deciding on what we're going to keep in this project, in this budget, in order to prevent us from falling much further behind. That's where we are, and we've got to recognize it. Whether it's because of the rules that were presented, whether it's the revenue streams coming out of the state, whether it's the federal revenue streams. The whole system right now is not geared towards providing the means that are necessary, the resources that are necessary to meet all the needs, let alone all the wants. So I think that's what we're going to be faced with, and that's what we'll be voting on in June. That's what we'll be deliberating on over the course of the next month. And I wish us all luck in that process. And if anybody's got a sound amendment to put forward some of those things which they think are a critical need, again, I will fairly evaluate everything before voting, but it is a steep hill. I want to commend the commissioner and the staff and the secretary and the staff for putting together what they have done. There are a lot of things I'd like to see changed in this. All those things are increases. There's not a single decrease in here that I would recommend, and that's the problem. And that's the problem I think we're all going to face when it comes time to amendment. So thank you very much.
Okay. I want to thank everybody for their attention. I would just mention two things. One is we're not in the business of micromanaging or running the department, so what we will be looking at are performance standards for these areas. That's how the budget is being constructed, and that's actually a first for this budget. So that's, I think, progress and part of transformation. I do think, you know, we all look these revenue estimates in the eye. Where we are today, we know we've not done enough in the way of cuts. And the latest estimate of federal revenues is very scary, and I take very seriously Mr. Witt's charge. Where are we over the long haul? I'm hopeful that we can take that issue up over the fall as we look realistically about what it's going to cost just to maintain pavements and bridges. Nobody's done that cumulatively. That's a scary number, but it is more than all the money we have of what's left just to do those two things. So I think we need to segment this. We do have to adopt a budget next month. I think the appropriate way to do it, and again, I just want to acknowledge the commissioner and the very hard work of his staff. What you're hearing is commissioner debate, but everyone is acknowledging the incredible professional quality of the work that you put together and the thoughtfulness behind it. And I think that's the right way to proceed, recognizing that line between policy and administration. And so we'll take that up in June. I know there'll be a lot more information that staff will be getting out. We'll have an opportunity to share thoughts, and particularly as information comes out. I will be transmitting the commissioner's recommendations to the General Assembly on Friday, so we'll likely hear back a little bit more on that. And I do think, again, just on a personal note, I think one of the things we spent so much time discussing rest areas that I don't want to spend any more time on it, but when we're laying off 1,000 people and we're worrying about bathrooms, I think we need to, you know, think very carefully about the balance and what is important.
I hope you're not implying, Mr. Secretary, that those of us that are raising that issue are not cognizant of that, because that's not true.
No, Mr. Davidson, I'm not. I'm not.
What is being said is a suggestion.
Mr. Davidson, excuse me one second.
I take that as a rather unpleasant analysis of
Mr.
comments
Davis,
that I've made.
May I finish my remarks, please? No one is saying that, and I've said this in a number of public settings, and this is a reflection on public hearings. When we talk about $3 billion of highway cuts, we talk about 1,000 full-time lifts. These are not vacancies. These are real people. When we talked about closing a third of our facilities, when we talked about having no money for economic development, if a cannon walked in the door today, do we have resources to bring that to Newport News? The answer is no. And I absolutely respect what you're saying, particularly about the aesthetics of the rest areas. That's a very real issue. But I do think that the debate on this in the public domain, and this is not at all pointed at you, it is how this bathrooms, for whatever reason, capture the imagination of the media and the public, because it's immediate and personal. People don't necessarily understand the nature of bridges or economic development, et cetera, et cetera. But we have and are in this budget are going down some pathways that are very, very profound. And I recall when Mr. Davies and Ms. Connolly were in the General Assembly in the early 90s when the Wilder budget cuts came in, and I remember Delegate Bob Harris going to the floor saying, ladies and gentlemen, we're fundamentally changing the way we fund higher education in Virginia, and didn't get a whole lot of attention paid to it. It was 10 years down the road before people started saying, hey, when did we change how we fund higher education? And Dr. Davis, you've dealt with that in your career. So please don't take my comment in that light.
I just didn't want you to trivialize. But
no, I, and I'm not, because I think the issue there is not so much the direct service. I think the point you raise is more about the symbolism, you know, what that means for Virginia as a welcoming state. That's an extremely valid comment. But I also think that that discussion, for a variety of reasons, has clouded the very real structural changes that are going on here in transportation. Local governments have no money. No money going forward. And one of our priorities has been to talk about integrating transportation and land use. How do you do that? That is as profound a change in transportation as anything that's happened in the last 50 years. And so, you know, my sense in saying and highlighting the rest area issue is, yes, it's important, it's symbolic, it's easily understood by the citizens, but the magnitude of the changes that we're undertaking here are very, very profound and will be felt for decades. And I fear in a very negative fashion, in particular the relationship with the localities. So I mention that in good cheer as colleagues, and I hope you'll accept the comment in that fashion. But there are some very significant issues embedded here, and I hope that we take a little bit more time, perhaps even tomorrow, to discuss some of those further, because these are very important. Dr. Davis, you're welcome to come back.
Well, the only comment I'll make back to you is this, that a lot of these changes obviously are profound in terms of the impact on local government, in terms of the impact on the general public. And we've discussed those, and I think the majority of us have accepted the fact that they're necessary and that we will go to local government and do our job in saying, we've made these changes because we didn't have a choice, and now you're going to live with the consequences of it for a long time unless you decide to do what you're capable of doing, of influencing those people that are going to Richmond to set overall policy to begin to change it. Because in my legislative career, I was a part of the Blyles and Robb administrations when there was hope and willingness to take some really tough decisions and raise the revenues to begin to address some of the issues that we dealt with. And it can be restored again. I'm confident of that. That's where Al and I we're not so far apart at all in terms of truth. We're a little bit apart maybe in the use of words in terms of what I believe can be possible. For now, we have to do the things that we're talking about. But that doesn't mean it always has to be that way. And we have to be the ones, I think, who speak up and keep saying there is a better day out there. There is a better way of doing this and not be satisfied with it. And that's what, to me, the rest area thing represents a little bit of that. I can't get my hands around the fact that local governments aren't going to have any money for transportation, hardly, and make any sense with the public. But I can tell you, when you get down to taking something like a rest area away from people who travel that road regularly, they understand that. So that's why I didn't want it trivialized and think that I didn't understand the bigger, broader issues. And I'm not upset about it. I just want to be sure we're all on the same page of being there.
Okay. And I think the symbolic value of that, that is something that is a little more easily understood than bridge ratings. I would say, last note, just in terms of aesthetics, there's a sleeper issue in here, which I think is the mowing standards. And when you don't mow, it's difficult to get the litter and the trash. I think it was Ms. Carter talked about our beautiful state and how clean and green it is. That's going to change.
Yeah.
And in many ways, that may be more profound and more visible and more noticeable to the average citizen than something which today, like the rest areas, is. And in my judgment, is going to have an equal impact on how, particularly outsiders and tourists, view the Commonwealth. I don't view that as healthy development either. Anybody else want to chime in before we go break for dinner as good colleagues and friends on this very difficult issue? It is late. How are we doing on reservations?
Okay.
All right. They're waiting for us. Everybody know where Acacia is? If not,
I'm
2601 West Cary.
Thank you.